Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
It just blows my mind that we have this piece of history right here. And for years, I've driven by and I never thought twice about it. And how many of us actually knew what this was?
What is it?
So you're looking at the Chrysler Air Raid Siren, installed in the 1950s as part of the Cold War hysteria of warning folks about a pending nuclear attack, which is kind of ironic considering the fact by the time this would actually sound, it would be too late for us to do anything about it.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. And this noise, it's the sound of one of those old Chrysler air raid sirens, just like the one that's still standing in Seattle's Finney Ridge neighborhood, which lost its electrical box a long time ago. But when it was working, this is what the neighborhood would hear every Wednesday at noon during the height of the Cold War.
And I heard from neighbors that they could hear it across Ballard. And when I was doing my research, they said you could hear it for up to 25 miles if the weather was, you know, moving in the right direction.
And that's history enthusiast Sue Pierce. She researches the history of the Ballard, Greenwood, and Finney Ridge neighborhoods and then writes about it on her blog, Vintage Westwood. We met up at the old air raid siren that stands at least 50 feet tall and is painted green and yellow. And by the way, it's one of the last standing sirens from the Cold War era in the country. Sue came across this piece of history one day when she was sitting at the Starbucks across the street with her young son, Andy.
We were staring at it, and I think my son actually pointed to it and asked, as a three-year-old, what is that? So we came over and we investigated what was underneath the air raid tower, and there isn't any information about it. So, you know, the next step is Google. And by all appearances, it looked like it was the last remaining tower.
Did you find out why it was placed in this particular spot?
I did. They originally were wanting to put the air raid siren at what is now West Woodland Park, but they decided not to. And the reason that was provided was it would be easier to explain the reason for the air raid siren to the children at the John B. Allen School versus explaining the reason to the monkeys at Woodland Park.
Where the zoo is.
Yeah.
That would freak them out.
Could you imagine?
So this was kind of hiding in plain sight
right,
for a long time for you. Did it make you wonder what else was hiding right in front of you that you needed to really take a second look at for the first time?
Absolutely. And there is so much around us. And simply by sitting down and having a cocoa with my son gave me the opportunity to actually think about my surroundings and to consider what could that possibly be, and then actually do something with that question and to research it.
So this is revealing history for you and the history in your neighborhood. How has this experience revealed a connection to your community?
For me, it was learning that my neighborhood was more than the accumulation of buildings or roads. It wasn't necessarily just a place where people were leaving their things and then going into downtown to Seattle to work every day. And that is how I treated the neighborhood when I first moved here. And after having my son, it forced me in a way to stop and look at where I was living. I want people to learn about our neighborhood. I want people to be excited about our neighborhood and to maybe fall in love with it the same way I have fallen in love with it.
Today on Sound Effect, stories of things hiding in plain sight, whether it's a relic of a war that came to an end decades ago, or the community around you. Sometimes we're moving so fast or we're so distracted that it can be hard to notice what's been in front of us all along. Coming up, we'll hear about a father spotting the signs of addiction in his daughter and himself. We'll visit a coffee shop in Bellingham that is trying not to be noticed. And we'll talk to a woman hidden among her peers in drag. It's all ahead on Sound Effect. Often, the things that are hiding in plain sight are objects we forget about until someone like Sue Pierce gets curious. But for the more than 200,000 people estimated to be living in the Northwest without legal permission, people hiding from immigration agents, no extra attention is desired. The Trump administration made a campaign promise to get rid of undocumented people in the U.S. Now, there's a lot going on with this issue, and we are not going to get into an analysis of the executive orders that have been signed, the lawsuits people are filing, and what the courts are ruling. What we are going to do is talk to Seattle-based immigration attorney Carol Edward about what she's seeing on the ground, what she's hearing from clients. She's been practicing law for 33 years. She's seen how immigration policies under Republican and Democratic administrations have played out. She served as the chair of the Washington State Chapter of American Immigration Lawyers. And today, Carol Edwards says the heightened focus on illegal immigration is prompting a lot of foreigners who are here legally to make more of a commitment to the United States.
What I think is really interesting is how many people are applying for citizenship. There's a lot of people who are lawful permanent residents and might not have applied for citizenship in the past, partly because in the past, if you became a U.S. citizen, you automatically gave up your other citizenship, which isn't the case anymore. It depends on what your country accepts. So people didn't want to give it up because they thought, well, I can live here, but I can also still own property in another country and have access to that. So now, everyone's showing up at the door for citizenship. Our number of naturalization applications that we're filing has greatly increased, and we're seeing everyone. These aren't just people who are Muslims. We're seeing Irish, we're seeing African, Japanese, Mexican. I mean, all across the board, people are saying, I'm afraid that if I'm not a citizen, somebody might deport me. So I think I'm just going to take that step. And the other reason, the exciting reason people are applying is they're saying, you know what, I haven't voted and I need to be involved in the system and vote. I need to do more than I've done before. And so I want to become a citizen. I want an opportunity to vote. I want a say in the government, in the community that I've been a part of for so many years. Now I want to even jump in further.
What if you're undocumented from Mexico or from a Central American country, and you are here and you have a family? What advice are you giving to those clients?
If they get a knock on the door, they don't have to open the door unless there's a warrant signed by a judge. And that's different than a lot of times immigration just knocks on the door and then comes in. It's very easy for them to get permission, have a child answer the door and say, I want to talk to so-and-so, and then they step in and they're in. So we're telling people, you know, your kids shouldn't be opening doors to strangers. Just because someone's wearing a uniform doesn't mean they should open the door. A person can walk over to a window and show you what it looks like, and you can take a picture of it, and you can make sure, you know, use a smartphone. Is that what a warrant's supposed to look like? Is it signed by a judge? You have some protection in your house. They're not just going to knock down the door. So the people who are going to be doing that are principally going to be the police, who have the right to, you know, execute a search warrant. And if they have a warrant for their arrest, then they certainly have to let them in or have to go outside to them, which we recommend. If they have a warrant for someone's arrest, step outside and let them arrest you. Don't let them inside your house. There's no reason for you to do that. If you are on the street, they have to have a reason to believe that you are an undocumented person in violation of immigration laws. So if you're speaking Spanish, that certainly doesn't mean that you're undocumented. If they come up and approach you, you can say, I don't want to talk to you. Under Washington law, you have to identify yourself, your name, to a law enforcement, but you don't have to give more information to immigration. So you can walk away. We're having a lot of conversations with people about that and going out into the communities and urging people to go talk to a lawyer. You might have an option you don't know about. What are these things that people might have? What are these loopholes where someone who is undocumented thinks that they don't have any chance of remaining in this country if that knock does happen? What are some of the criteria?
The options.
The options, yeah.
And I wouldn't even call them loopholes because really it's part of the immigration law. So one of the things that people don't know about is that people who are victims of crime. So you might have somebody who has suffered a horrible indignity in the past. We've had clients come forward with a rape where they actually caught the guy and the client testified against them and the person went to prison for years and years. And there's a viable option for them because they cooperated with the police, because they suffered a specific crime, and because the law enforcement involved signed off that they actually did cooperate. There's a visa they can apply for that provides them relief and can forgive their immigration transgressions, as it may be, and offer them an opportunity to stay in the United States, assuming they meet all the other criteria. And immigration looks at lots of different things all the time, and crime is always looked at.
What are some other puzzle pieces that can fit together that people might not know about?
Well, once in a while, I find somebody who's a citizen and never knew.
How is that possible?
I know, it seems amazing, doesn't it? Well, sometimes one of our cases was somebody whose father had custody of her, and she had come to the United States, and her father had naturalized when she was under 18, and she didn't know that that automatically made her a citizen by operation of law. She didn't have to do anything special, it just happened. So then she could go in and apply for a passport. Sometimes you have somebody who had a family member who was born in the United States and left at a young age, but had come back and lived here a certain amount of time, and they were a citizen. So derivative citizenship, how does it happen? And can somebody qualify and not know about it? And yes, it really does happen.
Who are your clients who are undocumented workers who are hiding in plain sight?
You know, it is quite amazing how widespread it is and how many people are there. A few years ago, I actually had a person who was an officer in the Coast Guard. Yes, believe it or not. And ultimately, we were able to take care of the issue. But it's really still widespread. When I was a brand new lawyer, amnesty came into play. And we had a number of people from the city of Seattle, engineers, I've had nurses, all kinds of people in all different areas. So one would assume that a person is necessarily a farm worker or working in, you know, housekeeping. And that's not necessarily the truth. It's actually pretty widespread. Certainly the people who are working in professional fields keep it very low key, and most people absolutely don't know. But sometimes, and certainly people who've been here for a long time, doesn't mean somebody's been here a long time, they necessarily have the right papers.
What power does Washington State have to work with and help undocumented immigrants in light of where our federal government stands right now?
Under the Constitution, the states have certain rights. They have the rights over families. Parents, divorce, adoption. These are all states' rights issues. So an interesting issue that I see on the horizon is that what rights do U.S. citizen children have to being raised by their parents? So in the dependency context, you'll find that children who become temporary wards of the state relating to child protection services, that they're always looking at what is in the best interest of this child. Would it be best for them to be placed with their parents? Would it best for them to be in a foster system? Would it be best for them to be grandparents? What are the rights of children to have their parents with them until they reach the age of 18? And this is the area of law that needs explored. And this is an area of law where I believe our governor can get involved and say, wait a second, I may not be able to give immigration benefits to this parent, but our courts and our system has the right to say what is best for the children of our state.
Who would have to file that lawsuit? Would that
have to come from the child?
Yeah, I think it does. It's going to have to come from the children. It's going to be from the children's rights to have their parent there. So we'll see. What can our governor do? What can Bob Ferguson, our attorney general, do? This is an area that they can look into.
Well, Carol Edward, thank you. Immigration attorney, thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today's theme is hiding in plain sight. If you owned a shop, you would probably want to get the word out about when it's opened, where it's located. Well, this is not the case for a small local business in Bellingham, Washington. In fact, this place is really a social experiment in disguise. Now, very few people know about this. It's happening in the middle of downtown Bellingham, and it deals with something that is extremely important to my life and probably to yours. The experiment involves coffee. Sound Effect contributor Alex Ashley brings us the story.
You could stare at this place for several minutes and still not see it. Onyx, a tiny coffee shop that sits along a side street in downtown Bellingham, Washington, seems to barely exist. There's no drive-thru, no parking, no easily visible sign. It's not easy to find. The only hint that it's even there is a small sandwich board in front of the door. And it's just as bare bones inside.
So we don't have any milk or cream or sugar. We don't have anything at all other than black coffee.
That's Edwin Martinez, the owner of Onyx Coffee. He says the simplicity of the place, totally by design.
The space is kind of a mad scientist lab that has evolved to being just a bar that's open one day a week for experimenting and learning more about human behavior with coffee. So it's kind of an incubator. I had a hypothesis that I didn't share with a lot of people because anyone I shared it with, they thought it was completely crazy.
Martinez actually gave a TED Talk on his experiment a few years ago in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
So. What I did is I had a plan. It's really a calculated experiment, and it's still open today, by the way. If you ever come through Bellingham, you can check it out. One person runs it, and we have nothing but coffee. The seating is not comfortable. There's no Wi-Fi. It's hard to find. There's no sign. There's no sugar. There's no cream. It's fantastic. So if
we open a place that intentionally does not have any of the values that people listed when I surveyed. The answers aren't what most people would think.
I'd say it's a good place to like meet up with people and like hang out. I feel like it's a good social environment.
I usually go there to study with friends or just kind of like relax and just draw and have time to myself. The coffee's good.
Yeah, the coffee's like frosting on the cake.
It's okay.
So if you love coffee, if you really want to engage, you are just in seventh heaven. But if you aren't there for the coffee, this is the most disappointing coffee house in America. And I love it. And my philosophy is often to pursue something that you love and put it out there. But does that mean it's going to be a good business?
And that's something I think. How's business doing?
Terrible.
So the brick and mortar shop, which Martinez opened in 2011, isn't his bread and butter. He supports himself mostly by growing and importing coffee, which he then sells to roasters. The coffee comes straight from his family's farm in the mountains of northwest Guatemala.
Huehuetenango.
It's been in the family since his grandfather, a pastor, bought the plot of land in the 1950s.
And his interest was not as much specifically coffee, but it happens to be that that's what was produced in that part of the country. And even to this day, over 90% of the agriculture in northwest Guatemala is coffee. And it's the most coffee-dense region in all of Guatemala. And so it wasn't something that he chose, but it checked that box for farmland, and he loved it. And now it's in our veins.
If he hadn't bought that land, you may not be doing what you do now.
Yeah, absolutely not. It could have been corn or sugar, and it would be totally, I can't imagine what that would look like. What I'm doing is simply taking what that farm produces and going through all the work of processing it, exporting it, and then importing it, selling it.
And he's learned something. In a coffee-centric culture, in a country that imports $4 billion of coffee every year and consumes 400 million cups a day,
the things that drive people to coffee are anything but the coffee.
He thinks he also knows why people view coffee the way they do in the Pacific Northwest. There's so much. There's coffee literally everywhere.
I think it's a very saturated coffee culture. The bottom of the bar is higher here, I think, than most parts of the country. However, the top of the bar is, I think, also lower than most parts of the country. And the reason for that is when, I think, under the shadow of Starbucks, just having specialty coffee evolve with really espresso and Italian culture and espresso-based beverages, we had a large, a disproportionate growth in the Pacific Northwest of espresso-based beverages and places that had them. We quickly became the experts, but we've really failed to evolve because we're saturated with connoisseurs.
If Martinez has proved anything with Onyx Coffee, it's that the Pacific Northwest, places like Seattle and Bellingham, have too many options. You could practically throw a dart and hit a coffee shop. And those shops are now offering so much more than coffee that it's become one of the last reasons people go there in the first place. Even so, Martinez is busier than ever in the coffee business. Onyx is still open. The great experiment is still running. So if you can find it, you can still get a cup of really, really good coffee.
That story from sound effect contributor Alex Ashley. This is Sound Effect. I'm Jennifer Wing. And if you're just joining us, we're telling stories about hiding in plain sight. People with addictions often go to great lengths to hide their problem from family and friends. Michael Roberts of Kirkland knows this well. He had his first drink at 15. He developed a habit and tried for years to keep attention away from his alcoholism. His last drink was 8 years ago. His struggle and the efforts he made to keep his problem hidden made him an expert when it came to spotting his daughter's addiction. Her name is Amber, and before she fell into trouble, she was a happy kid who was always thinking of other people first.
She was one of those people who liked to take care of everyone and sometimes forget about herself. Loyal, will drop anything for a friend. Her smile was just radiant.
But then Michael started to notice changes in his daughter. She was more moody and started to isolate herself away from her friends. She was hooked on heroin and was not able to stop. Amber died of a heroin overdose almost 2 years ago at the age of 19. In his daughter's memory, Michael created an organization called Amber's Hope. The HOPE stands for Heroin, Opiate Prevention, and Education. He sat down with 88.5's Ariel Van Cleve, who asked Michael what he did to hide his own addiction to alcohol.
I would just lie. You have to lie. You know, I didn't want to talk about myself or my feelings. Oh, yeah, I'm great. Even though I'm, you know, probably $10,000 in debt, you know, struggling just to have my mind be clear. You start alienating everybody because you don't want to hear it. You don't want to hear them telling you, you look at yourself, please, in the mirror and you need help.
One of the ways that you confronted Amber was going through her stuff.
Yeah, every chance I got.
You would leave notes?
Yeah.
For her?
Uh-huh.
I can only imagine, like as a, speaking personally, when I was a teenage girl, if I had seen notes in my drawers from my dad.
Yeah, and what's funny is I would do it, but she would still leave it. I don't know if it had an effect or not. I know she read them. I know she got them. And that's all I cared about.
Have you heard from other parents who did something similar and it, you know, and it worked or it didn't work? Because I think that's one of those like stereotypical, like, well, I'm going to go through their room and I'm going to find some things and then we're going to discuss it.
Yeah. What I found out is no, parents are scared to do that. They're trying to be best friends with their kids. That doesn't work. You have all the rights in the world as a parent to go through their rooms. With all the chaos that kids have these days with school, sports, job, you know, it's both parents are working. Sometimes you only have 10, 15 minutes with their kid. And you got to pick, like, do you want to have a fight or not? I think hopefully with me talking, speaking about it, that they'll pick the fight more often because it could save their life. But what I've noticed after I've done speaking at the event about awareness and telling the story of my daughter, I have a whole group of parents come up to me and ask questions. You know, how do I do this? How do I talk to them? What are the red flags?
The red flags, those signs. I want to talk specifically in the time leading up to Amber's death.
Okay.
From what I understand, it happened. Things accelerated quickly.
Yes.
What did you first notice and what did you then try to do in that moment in
right.
time?
Well, we knew, you know, she was drinking and smoking pot. And then later on in high school, found out she was taking ecstasy. So the only thing that you could do, or what I felt we could do, was just keep an open dialogue about drugs and alcohol. She was good in school. She had a job right when she was 15. Great work ethic. Had all of her friends through high school. And then she was getting a little bit more depressed. And then I noticed, this is in 2015, she was just turned 19. She started alienating her friends, which is not her. And at this time, she was living at her mom's, so I didn't see her that often. And then we had dinner, I want to say probably a month before she passed. I could just tell by her physical disposition, something wasn't right. I had an idea, I thought it might be heroin. You know how your child is, and just the opposite of her behavior that she's had for 19 years. And then the weekend that she died, she went to Paradiso, the big EDM rave in the Gorge. She loved that stuff. And I get a call from her mom saying that Amber wants to come home because she doesn't feel well and she's crying, wants us to come pick her up. The first thought I had when I heard that was she's dope sick. And I was trying to get out of work to go get her because I don't want her to go get heroin, essentially. So, you know, I'm at work and we're deciding what to do. And in the meantime, Amber had a friend of hers come pick her up. And then she died that night. And during that time, I was setting up treatment for her, get her into treatment and detox. And I was going to be taking her the day I got the phone call.
What was the time frame for this?
First time she tried heroin was February of 2015.
February of 2015.
Yeah, she died 5 months later.
So did you have any desire during all this to go get a drink?
No.
No.
Which probably 4 months later after she passed, I realized that. Like, I did not think of using, drinking, not even once. That was the farthest thing from my mind, which shocked me. I think one reason, if I did, I probably would have killed myself, more than likely.
Hmm.
And maybe just something was like, you can't do that right now.
As someone who has heard the talk and given the talk, are there like best practices? How do you do that? How do you, how do you bring it up?
I don't know. It's, you have to have a beginning conversation to see where it's going, because you don't know. I mean, if you can read the person and know how they are mentally and physically, et cetera, you maybe be able to know which direction to go. But even then, because an addict is so, out there, they could just flip a switch and just turn off and walk away, essentially, or scream back at them, or who knows. The fact that you could just bring it up, that's great. And that's just what you need to do. If they need help, or if you think you're seeing them going in a direction, is this, I love you, just know that. But the addict will know that and know you're right. They will deny it because we don't want to get told, what to do or how we feel.
All of this sounds very familiar. My dad was an alcoholic and my older brother died of a heroin overdose, just like Amber. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of things, the lying and denying, got real good at it over time. And I got really good at spotting it over time.
Right.
Now I think that my detector is a little on the fritz because I go overboard.
And that's not always bad. Overboard's better than underboard.
Exactly. But I think the most extreme thing that he did after being told one of the last times that he needed to go and get help was he moved two states over.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I think that's one of the things that isn't talked about enough is the personality side of the addiction and not just the biological side of the addiction.
Right.
Because as you were just saying, what's going to happen while I try to confront them about this?
Yeah.
Do you think that that part could be a little more, you know, discussed? Or do you think it works out?
I think that part is one of the major parts that needs to be discussed because that's what scares everybody. You know, we're not bad people. And it's tough to see that because you're not living in their head. Growing up, everyone talked about alcoholics or drug addicts as, you know, losers, junkies. But little do you know that your son's popping Vicodin like there's no tomorrow. And do you think he's going to come to you and ask for help? No, because he already feels bad enough. It's a mind game.
No parent wants to be in the position that you're in.
Mm-hmm.
Has anything good come out of all of this that you feel has been kind of a, I don't want to say bright spot, but.
No, you can. Yeah, because it is. You know, it is. I'm really critical. In my perspective, I haven't seen a whole hell of a lot change. It's like we like to be retroactive on everything. When we're talking government here, because that's where we need the most help. You know, we a lot of people have the nonprofits. I have Amber's Hope. There's Not One More. There's Shatter. All this stuff. But we're all talking to each other. People who come to these events are people who have been through it. It's coming along. I'm just going to keep telling my story. It's hard reliving her death every time I talk. And every time I start feeling like that, I'll get something or someone will call who I have no idea who they are and say, thank you. That lifts me back up again. At least, you know, okay, it's working. It's working.
That was 88.5's Ariel Van Cleve talking with Michael Roberts. He's the founder of Amber's Hope, a nonprofit created in memory of his daughter who died of a heroin overdose. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today we're telling stories of things that are hiding in plain sight. All around us, there are tiny creatures and simple organisms sharing planet Earth, and that includes a type of worm that prefers to live in rotting fruit.
And they're barely can see it by eye, so they're about 1 millimeter long, and they're transparent.
That's Jihong Bai. He is a neurobiologist at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle. And he uses these microworms, barely the size of the tip of a human hair, to study how neurons in the brain talk to each other. Well, at least that's what he used to study. Then a chance observation of the worms led him to a new discovery about worm behavior. It all started with Jihong's lab technician, who was tasked with taking pictures of the worms under a microscope. And he put the worms in a little plastic chamber that kind of looks like an upside-down Lego, and he noticed these very simple creatures all hung out in just one area of the chamber.
So we had this discussion in a lab meeting, and I thought, you must be crazy.
What did he say that made you say that?
So he said, well, the worm is behaving differently in different chambers, and I'm so curious about it. They're making decisions about what they do. We actually had this discussion for probably 2 lab meetings, and eventually I sort of fed up. I said, well, if this is the case, if you make a chamber that has different kind of environment, now you can see the animals behave differently. You can just observe. And if you find that, let me know. And he went back to the lab. I thought I would never hear from him again. But I think probably 2 weeks later, and he just come over and said, I'm going to show you something. And I see they're all clustered into one spot. And I'm like, wow, this is quite interesting behavior. So that's where this phenomena triggered us to follow up why the worm is staying in this particular physical environment.
Versus others that were venturing out?
Right. So we later on figure out that not all the worms behave the same. So that's where we started to figure out why there's such a diversity.
So there are different varieties from all over the world.
Right. We studied one that from Bristol, England, from Hawaii, from California, from South Africa. We studied 12 strains from different areas. I think started from curiosity, we just decided, say, well, human, when we see the same environment, we don't do the same behavior. Would that be something we can see in worms?
So to explore this idea of whether these simple creatures are similar to humans, to see if they make different decisions about where to go and what to do when they're in the same space, Jihang and his lab built a small maze of those plastic Lego chambers to see how the different strains of worms reacted.
The Bristol strains is very clear that they cluster in a particular area. So they will initially fully explore this chamber, then they eventually accumulate here. But if you have a Hawaii strain, they will explore the areas randomly and they will not stop at anywhere. So if you look in after 30 minutes or 60 minutes, those worms in a chamber, you will see the Bristol strains were clustered in one area, but Hawaii strain worms are all over the place.
And as researchers, you want to know the answer, why that behavior is so different.
Right. So that's what we're trying to figure out. We see the animal behave very differently, but they're cousins. Now we're trying to understand what is, you know, the neurobiology reason, the molecular reason for that change.
Now, the molecular reason gets really complicated pretty fast, but basically, Jihang says it has to do with dopamine, a hormone that controls risk and reward and a ton of other behaviors. And it does that for humans, too.
Human and worms are so different, but we're using the same chemicals to connect the environment and our behavior.
Yeah, I guess that relates to my next question, which is how can you apply it to people?
I think that addresses a very fundamental question, is why we behave differently when we interact with the same world. A fundamental issue of evolution is the diversity. So if everyone behaves the same, or every animal behaves the same way, then there's a challenge comes in, then there's nothing to select from, because everyone is the same. But variations build in this diversity in different behavior or aspects of our life. So when challenge comes in, there's something to select from.
Figuring out why these tiny worms that, by the way, are probably in your yard if you have a fruit tree, figuring out why they behave differently, why the Hawaii worms are so free to explore, and why the worms from England stick close together, this will help scientists understand evolutionary diversity in humans. Jihang says all of these differences are what's allowed our species to survive. Ultimately, Jihang is curious about how these particular worm brains work because of what it could mean for human brains. So why not just study people? Well, because these tiny creatures are a lot easier to understand. Humans have billions of neurons that determine how we function. Jihang's worms only have 302. It's easier to connect the dots with worms. Jihang's lab is hoping that these simple creatures can help us understand more complex ones in the future. Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX, and today our theme is hiding in plain sight. And in a way, this is what dancer Jodi Keener does every time she steps on stage as her drag persona, Shardana Shanatra. Shardana is a colorful and exuberant ball of energy. And because it's far less common for women to be drag queens, Shardana's over-the-top makeup and costuming conceal Jodi, hiding her well enough to the point where some audience members incorrectly assume that she is a man. And this has resulted in some pretty awkward conversations between Jody and a few of the people in the audience. Jody's work challenges expectations about gender, and she describes the colorful persona she has created in Shardana as a spoonful of sugar with the medicine.
I am going for an extreme idea of femininity. So big hair, giant eyelashes, huge eyebrows, lots of makeup, lots of glitter, over-exaggerated features, so as much as I can bump up, like large lips and really rosy cheeks. And I definitely move a little bit more into clown in that way, as far as the aesthetics of it. Shardana really is playful, childlike, says yes to everything. Shardana's lens is a little bit more psychedelic in a way.
So how did it start?
I moved here at the same time as another performer, Ricky Mason, and we danced in many forms together and became friends. And we're queer people and really wanting to work within some gender play and performance in a different way. So we just started to make some duet work, working with ideas of gender. It was very organic. It really came out of curiosity. And then through that, Shardana came about, and Ricky has a drag king persona called Lou Henry Hoover. And then we made work as those characters together for a good 5 years.
Well, the sun is surely sinking down. I love it, slowly rising. So this whole world.
Discovering this character really has shifted me personally.
How?
Back then, I was a little bit more androgynous in my day-to-day and was still figuring out how my femininity was. And Shardana has given me really a platform for myself personally to figure out what my femininity is. I mean, I didn't wear any makeup, and it was a little bit of a leap and a struggle for me to kind of get into all of that. Because I also have issues with that. I think it's crappy that we've decided that women look better with makeup than without. You know, 7 years ago, I was maybe a little more resistant to wearing makeup. Now I have a little more interest in it, or interest in the play, even in my day-to-day life, that one day you can be super high femme and one day you can be more androgynous, and that's all fine. I think Shardana has allowed me to have a little more boldness in my day-to-day.
How is Jody Keener different from the heart of Shardana?
Not really at all. I don't have a real separation. I think Shardana is just almost more of Jody. It's just a vehicle to not have to be restricted by social norms or what's expected. And it's a way that I get to really fully embody all of everything I'm feeling and thinking in these moments.
When you do a performance and people think that you are a man and then find out that you are a woman, what kind of reactions do people have to that information?
The saddest reaction that happens sometimes is relief. When I was in Philadelphia and I did a show, and there was an older, definitely cis man. We took a photo, and then he came over to me later and was like, "Oh, you're a woman. Oh," and just had such a relief that, like, now it's okay and now we're all right. It was one of the first moments where I kind of dropped out and just started to ask him, like, "So if I was a man, we wouldn't be all right?" And he was like, "Oh, well, you know," I'm not like that. And I said, "Well, so you don't have any men friends?" And he was like, "Oh, no, I got men friends." And I was like, I just didn't want to let him go on it because it's just so ridiculous. And maybe that's just what it is for me now, is that I have a little less tolerance to brush it off. If I'm going to talk to people and meet and greet, then I'm going to, like, tell them how I really feel, which I think is okay. after the shows, a lot of times we do like a meet and greet thing, and people are really just like checking me out. They're figuring out, they're listening to my voice. And it is almost like a training of audiences of the etiquette, which you should do actually in life as well. Like, you're not going to go up to a person who's presenting as femme on the street and ask them if they're wearing a wig. So I think the training overlaps into real life, or I think it's good for them, so that when they talk to Sheridana and they start asking me about my aesthetic, that, you know, I always respond with, this is my real hair, that what you're seeing is what it is. There's no need to know my genitalia is basically what I'm trying to say.
Do people come out and ask you, are you a woman or are you
a man?
Oh,
yeah, for sure.
What do you tell them?
In creating Sheridana, I wasn't necessarily going for that kind of like trickery, so to speak. I really was just exploring my high femininity, but I wasn't trying to be a female, like a female body person inside of a male. Like, I wasn't trying to do that stack. That's kind of come out of it. And so I need to address it, because that is part of what's going on, whether I wanted that or not. How my exploration of high femininity is causing people to think I'm male-bodied is just wild. I think that's the ultimate change that needs to happen, is why is there comfort in knowing if somebody is a male, man or a woman? Who cares?
Strictly from an artistic place, and you were not setting out to write some thesis or do some anthropological undercover research.
Yes.
But you realize that this work is nuanced and does have weight in these areas that touch on prejudice and touch on preconceived notions and gender stereotypes and roles. And it sounds like you are evolving with that and are trying to work with that. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yeah, definitely. There's so much still to explore, and even year to year, my interest through Sheridana shift just seems like there's a lot to mine out of it.
You can catch Jody deconstructing Isbin's classic in Sheridana's Dollhouse, April 28th through May 15th at Washington Ensemble Theater. Her upcoming residency at the Henry Art Gallery will also culminate in a series of performances entitled Clock That Construct, May 18th through the 21st. Well, this brings us to the end of the show. Sound Effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad and Allie Ferguson. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. We get web help from Dave Nagaris. Parker Miles Blom gets the word out on social media. Special thanks this week goes out to 88.5's Ariel Van Cleve and Alex Ashley. Our intern is Amanda Abbott. And you can find Sound Effect on the NPR One app. And you can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. And do you like trivia? If so, you are in luck, because Sound Effect is hosting a trivia night coming up next week on April 11th at 7:30. It's going to be at Murphy's Seattle Irish Pub in Wallingford. Come play by yourself or bring a team as big as 8 of your Brainiac friends. There'll be prizes for the winners and a chance to meet and chat with the staff of Sound Effect and some other KNKX folks. It's free, but seating is limited and it's a first-come, first-served basis, so you might want to get there a little bit early. We'll be back next week when our theme is, It's About Time.
And then, at the age of 30, I say it at last. I love you, Dad.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.